Next up, from one fun issue to the next, we're going to have Scott Rawlings come up to make sense of the chaos in national politics here next. Scott Rawlings has over 28 years of professional experience in the agricultural policy arena. In 2011, Scott joined the staff of Wilbur Ellis Company as a director of regulatory and governmental affairs, where he serves as the company's advisor on all government and industry relation programs. He also works with senior management to ensure that the company's regulatory and governmental affairs strategy minimizes the risk while meeting organizational objectives related to regulation. Scott, you want to come on up?
Good morning. Thanks for inviting me. I'm going to try to divide my talk up into two sections, talk about what's going on here in Oregon now and a little bit federally, and at lunch talk about what's going on in Washington, D.C. And I have to tell you, Janice and I didn't talk before coming here, nor did I talk with Marianne, but what she said and what Marianne were a perfect lead into what I want to talk about. So let's get to it. If we can. Oh. Well, here's my overview. We are losing touch with agriculture because people outside of agriculture get information about you guys from everyone but you, which leads to bad policy at the local, state, and federal level. And actually, you're winning in Oregon. You lead the country in anti-agricultural activity, which I'll touch on. And the Washington, D.C. chaos is hampering our ability to get things done. But a couple good things have happened. So let's start with this slide. I use this slide a lot, which kind of backs up what Janice just talked about. Let's look back at 1950. The population of the U.S., 151 million. Farm population was 25 million people. That's a staggering number. One in six Americans lived on a farm. Average farm size, just over 200 acres. The number of tractors on farms exceeded horses in 1954. We've come a long way since 1950. But back then, everyone had a connection to a farmer. Now let's fast forward to today. Population, just over 320 million. Farm population, full-time farmers, about 2 million. One out of every 160 Americans has a connection to a farm. And now you can't find, most consumers don't know a farmer. They've never met a farmer, they've never seen a farmer. And I use this a lot too, consumers sucking and blowing at the same time, which I think you will agree is impossible. I know some of you are trying to do that right now, but it doesn't work. Consumers want food produced locally by small farmers that they know, that they're familiar with. They want organic, they want non-GMO. But they also want rigorous, complicated regulatory standards on food safety. They want traceability back to where that exact spot in a field where that crop was grown. High quality, low cost, and year-round availability. In other words, they want some very complicated things that only large farmers can do and do well. And when Costco buys from a farmer, they have to get all the box checked, and small farmers have a hard time doing that. And that's why large farms dominate. Now the green bar there are farm size, and the green is small farms. That's less than 350,000 gross farm income a year. 90% of farm numbers are small farms in the U.S. And they operate about 50% of the acres, and they produce about 25% of the food. The large farms, middle-sized farms, and non-family farms make up about 10% of farm numbers. They farm about 50% of the acres, and they produce 75% of the food. Very small percentage of growers are growing most of the food in this country, and this is from USDA data. Now let's go on to, there's some good news and some bad news. Consumers like farmers. Now I found this picture on the internet, and I Googled a picture of an Oregon seed grower, and this is what came up. So I don't know who this is, But strangely enough, you can find this. But consumers don't like agriculture. And Janice Gents went through a bunch of reasons why this is true, but they watch documentaries like Food Inc., Farmageddon, and at the top, it's hard to see, it says, "The Unseen War on American Family Farms." They see these documentaries and they get scared. GMO, OMG. And these are hard to watch for a farmer. And Janice, I know you've probably watched them. They're tough to watch because it just drives me crazy what they're saying in here. The result of this documentary mindset and people getting information about farmers from everyone but you is they have almost no firsthand accurate knowledge of how farmers produce food. This void is filled by people who have no knowledge of farming, and some of them have cult hero status. Do you know who this is? Janice does. This is the food babe. She is on a kick to get all chemicals out of food. And if you Google food babe, you'll see that she's attacked Starbucks, she's attacked Subway about using certain chemicals in the coffee and in their sandwiches. And she has cult hero status. This, Dr. Oz, has his own show. He's got some pretty wacky ideas about farming as well. Anyone who know who this is? Michael Pollan. He wrote the book, The Omnivore's Dilemma. He has this huge following on Twitter and on Facebook and on social media, and some interesting ideas about agriculture. How about this? Who knows who this is? Oh, come on. Awesome. Trick question. That's my wife. She's not here right now, so I can say she doesn't know a lot about agriculture. I'm just kidding. 37 years we've been married. She's a worker. We grow apples in Wisconsin. So in my previous employment before Wilbur Ellis, I worked for a company called Moctashim. Now goes by Adama. It's a pesticide registrant. And I was VP of Regulatory Affairs. I had a staff of about 10. This is PhD toxicologists, PhD chemists, regulatory people. None of them grew up on a farm. Most of them had never been to a farm, except a few who had been to a pumpkin patch to buy a pumpkin before Halloween. So their knowledge of agriculture is near zero. So I gave them what I call the Rawlins Ag IQ test and showed them a few pictures. This is one of the pictures I showed them. To be fair, they knew that these were cows. And when I asked, do you know what kind of breed it is? You know, like a dog is a German Shepherd and there's dachshunds and retrievers. No, they don't know. Is it a beef or dairy cow? No, I don't know. So when I tell them it's a Holstein and these are dairy cows, they're interested. But what do you think they took away from this picture? Their head is caught in these bars. Why would a farmer do that? So I have to explain that to them. And then the one that's kind of looking at the camera there has got an ear tag that says 1957. Is that the year he was born? No. And it's not a he. This is a dairy cow. They give milk. They have to think about that a little bit. So I show this next. What do you think they thought this was? This is a dirt thrower. And they laugh when I tell them it's a manure spreader, you know, it's throwing poop out there, and they just, oh, that's so funny. And this, which, is this some sort of toxic waste that farmers are putting on their field? No, that's liquid manure. And they, liquid manure, is this from animals that have diarrhea? I mean, these are the questions. No, I explained that to them. Didn't know what this was. Are those snouts used for maybe digging a furrow or something and then you put a seed in there? No, this is a combine. This is with pick corn. And then they kind of see the corn in the background. Oh, okay, I get it. And he thought on what this, they thought this might be. This is a dirt smoother. They don't call soil soil, they call soil dirt. And this is smoothing the soil and I guess it's making it nice and even so it's more smooth to drive over. So that's where we have a disconnect, and some people don't think it's that bad, but I can tell you it's pretty bad. They don't know what's fact and what's fiction. So this was something that a trade group ran, Victory. Cheerios goes non-GMO. Now, there are no GMO oats, so Cheerios was always non-GMO, but they're claiming Victory because somehow they found out that oats were not GMO. But this is intended to mislead consumers, in my opinion, because while Cheerios is non-GMO, the other guy's oat cereal might be GMO. And we see that. This is something that Trader Joe's used to have in their store, warning may contain GMOs. This is what consumers see. This is why they're afraid, Janice, exactly why you pointed out. And Chipotle, who I think is one of the worst at misleading consumers, Chipotle commits to 100% GMO-free. And then the asterisk on the bottom of this ad says, well, the pork, chicken, and beef that we serve in our burritos was probably fed GMO grain. The corn tortilla chips are GMO. The sugar in our soft drinks is probably corn syrup GMO or beet sugar GMO. So, but they're committed to 100% GMO-free. So we have to be proud of them. Now here's some non-GMO olives, and you see these signs in the grocery store all the time. This is at a Whole Foods. The olives on the left there are non-GMO, and the olives on the right, the medium ripe pitted olives, there's no sign there. So that would lead a consumer to believe those olives might be GMO. So this is what consumers are bombarded with every day. And my point here is this does affect public policy. And I think this is the last one. This is teas, tea bags, and strings. All the strings on their tea bags are non-GMO, which, I mean, you can't make this stuff up. So, Crop Life America is the trade group for the pesticide registrants, Monsanto and Syngenta, BASF. Wilbur Ellis is a member. So Crop Life tracks anti-agricultural activity at the state and federal level. And these are the most active anti-ag states. And you saw Marianne from Farm Bureau. Excellent presentation. You got a lot going on out here. You are winning. So you're number one. Washington, two. California, Hawaii, four West Coast states. Then Colorado, Minnesota, New York, and Florida. Not sure why Minnesota is in here, but it is. You know, I live in Wisconsin next door. So, but that's kind of the outlier. And, you know, I'm going to go into a theory why I think the West Coast, and in particular Oregon, is so bad. I'll start with this. So in these three states, there's 50 million people. And I'm being generous by saying there's 100,000 farmers. You guys are outnumbered. 50 million to 100,000, you're simply outnumbered. So I'll get into that a little bit. So here's what's going on out here. And just plug Marianne's presentation into the slide. And you got a lot going on, more than any other state. So go back to Crop Life American Research to kind of figure out what is driving this. So Crop Life did some survey work, a consumer attitude survey, did some focus groups, and we found that the activist groups are very involved out here in Oregon on the West Coast. And they fight dirty. And fighting dirty means they're not afraid to lie. And they import people to hotspot locations, which would be out here. They get local officials to act quickly so they can dominate discussion at meetings that are held at the last second. And this is a key point. Their message is cultural. Science is their enemy. So who are these activists? It's mostly white women, 30 to 60 years old, upper middle class, primary meal preparer. They get a lot of information online, and they say they're in good health. And why are they winning? And why are we losing? They act faster. They're social media experts. And that follows up on what Janice talked about. We have to get to their same level. They use anecdotes to refute science. They don't use science to refute science. They have to use anecdotes. They rely on emotion, anger, and I would say fear. And they get local politicians to act without all the facts, and they outnumber us. So Crop Life in 2016 came out here to a beautiful state of Oregon. We went to Portland to do some focus group discussions, and we had two groups out here in Oregon, or in Portland, upper middle class women
with children who vote, and upper middle class retirees who volunteer and vote. And sat them around, 20 around a table, and I could watch while they were having their discussion. They didn't know I was watching, so you could hear what they're saying. We're just trying to figure out what they think. So where do you go to get information about farmers? They go to environmental group websites. They go to NRDC, Environmental Working Group, the Sierra Club. They go to the produce manager at Whole Foods, who could be an 18-year-old teenager. Or one woman said, well, I have a cousin who has a friend who has a neighbor who knows a farmer, which is, of course, not quite firsthand knowledge. So we ask them, do you trust EPA when it comes to making decisions about whether pesticides are safe? Do you trust EPA? This is a picture of EPA headquarters in our nation's capital, and the answer is no, we don't trust EPA. Do you trust scientists? No. Scientists are paid for by Monsanto and Syngenta and Wilbur Ellis. They're paid to lie. So to kind of dig in deeper to these issues, CropLife commissioned a survey of 6,500 adults, online survey, spring of 2016, and here's what we came up with. Americans are scared about a host of challenges, including where their food comes from. Going back to what Janice said, there's fear. They do not trust traditional sources of information. And within agriculture, non-traditional influencers have built a loyal following. That's Dr. Oz, that's the food babe. So when you ask them without prompting them about agriculture, how concerned are you about the following issues? And the blue is adults, red is Republicans, and green is women, if you can't see the index on the bottom. So a lot of people concerned about terrorism, climate change, pesticide use in ag. 25 to 30% say, yeah, they're concerned about that. And surprising to me, GMOs are a little lower than that. Who do you trust? They trust health professionals, other family members, friends, and then it starts to fall off. TV news, Google, newspaper, and you'll notice at the bottom, US government, EPA, FDA, and companies. They don't trust them at all. So when you actually give them a list of things about food, so which of the following food items do you actively try to avoid? I don't know if you can see it on the far left. 6% say they avoid animal products. They avoid meat. And at the high end, they avoid foods with high sugar content, high salt, and then third place, pesticides. And again, surprising to me is GMOs are in the middle, about 30%. I can't quite see from here. So among demographic groups, who is with us on pesticides? Who agrees with us that pesticides are necessary and vital? We have one group. We have the 80 to 87-year-olds. So my mom and dad are, mom's 87, dad's 88. We've got them. How about pesticides dangerous and unhealthy? Everyone else is over here. So we have work to do. We've got to find a way to communicate with people who don't know much about agriculture and don't agree with us. Are there any silver bullet messages? You know, Janice, asking questions, I think, is probably a key thing to do whenever you encounter someone who doesn't agree with you. We don't have any silver bullet messages that are going to convince them that we're right on this. We know it doesn't work anymore. We thought for years, well, you know, pesticides and fertilizer keep food prices down, pesticides meet strict safety standards, help grow more food, protect crop from pests, and they don't agree with that. But 30% say there is no good reason to use pesticides, period. 30%. So why Oregon? Why are you winning? I'm sure that you've been winning so much you're getting tired of all the winning. So, but you do have an issue out here. And this is my opinions here of why Oregon is where you are. And it's I'll go into each one of these in a little more detail. The I-5 effect, your population is separated from ag. You got people moving in from other states. the initiative process, and there's, you know, there is a desire for weirdness here. And, you know, the Portland said, keep Portland weird. I mean, they're doing the level, their level best to do that. You may have other opinions on this that I'd love to hear. So you have thousands of people driving by farms on I-5 every single day. And I drove from the Portland airport yesterday down to Salem. You know, there's ag on both sides of the road. And when they see a farmer out there on a tractor doing something, what the heck is he doing? They don't know what you're doing. And they're questioning it. They can just see that every day. And you have people, you know, from the border of California all the way up to Portland, a lot of agriculture there, a lot of people driving by every day, and they don't know what you're doing. Now you go out to Montana, and you see this, or South Dakota, or North Dakota, there's agriculture there, but there's nobody driving up and down the roads, and we have almost no issues in those least populated states. And the states where we have the most problems, our most populated states, are where we have the most problems. So you have 36 counties here. Your top five counties by population account for 60% of your population. The top 10, almost 80%. Here's your top five counties. You know, the Portland area, then Lane County, and that's where 60% of your population is. What county area are we in right now? Marion, okay. Well, this is one of the counties. And people are coming to Oregon to flee high-tax states and for lifestyle reasons. It's beautiful out here. They're bringing their politics with them. And they're coming from California. So there's been egress out of California, and this is a little bit dated, but these are the top five destinations for Californians fleeing the state. Texas is one, but Oregon is right there, and you're picking up 30,000 people a year from California, and that's obviously had an impact. And where are Americans moving? This is from United Van Lines, and they track where are people moving to. What's the number one state that people are moving to? You're number one. And they're moving out of high-tax states, New Jersey, New York, Illinois. Illinois is broke. North Dakota. Who could figure that? West Virginia, Ohio, Kansas, New Mexico, Pennsylvania, and Connecticut moving out of there. And moving in Oregon, the Carolinas, Vermont, and Florida. I mean, they're coming here. And it's your initiative process. You have state and local initiatives, county initiatives. It's easy to qualify an initiative for the ballot here in Oregon. In the past 50 years, what are the top two states in terms of qualifying initiatives for the ballot? You're winning. Oregon's number one, California's number two. And the weirdness. This is some sort of parade. He put a lot of money into this, so you have to give him credit for that. It's a Chevy Astro. It resales probably not too much right now, but. So I do want to, I'm going to switch a little bit to some federal issues, and at lunchtime I am going to talk about Mr. Trump and politics and what's going on in D.C. and about the swamp. So Waters of the U.S. rule fits into that. EPA's had a number of evolving definitions of what is a water of the U.S., and I'm not going to get into that. There are many waters of the U.S., and the Clean Water Act, which governs this, says the federal government can regulate navigable waters. Navigable. What does that mean? You can put a boat on it. You can drive around on it. And initially, if you could jump over it, it wasn't navigable. If you couldn't jump over it, that's something you could regulate. So that ditch there in a house in Potomac, Maryland, under the old rule, that was a water of the U.S. And how many of those ditches would you see out here in Oregon? You'd see a bunch of them. So to give you an idea of how this affects the landscape, this is an area, 48 square miles in northern Kentucky, near the suburbs of Cincinnati. And in this area, there's 47 miles of perennial streams, 96 miles of intermittent streams. Now, the perennial streams are navigable. the intermittent are not. And then there's ephemeral streams, which are only present during rare rain events or water events. So 47-mile perennial streams, 96 miles of intermittent streams. Now you add in the ephemeral streams, and here's what you have. 384 miles of ephemeral streams, which are now would have been included under the waters of the U.S. rule and would have been regulated by federal action. And they're not navigable. So that's why a court overturned at WOTUS and why the Trump administration is starting over. And it would require you, if you're in one of these areas, to get a Clean Water Act permit if you want to apply pesticides or fertilizer. EPA said this wasn't true, but the plain language of the law said, or the rule said, yeah, it was. So I'm going to end up here. And after lunch, I'm going to talk about what's happening in our nation's capital try to take a lighthearted look at it. So hopefully you'll be able to join for that. So I want to kind of close on a couple of things about educating consumers. This is a Far Side cartoon. And what we say to dogs, the owner says, okay, Ginger, I've had it. You stay out of the garbage. Understand, Ginger? Stay out of the garbage or else. And Ginger hears, she only hears her name. That's pretty good. Now, what we say to cats, you can tell a cat anything. They don't hear a word we say, which is where we are with a lot of consumers. We need to work to the dog level, and then hopefully beyond that to something better, as Janice suggested. So with that, I don't know if there's time for questions or we're ready to go to lunch, but anyway, thank you for your kind attention, and we'll talk to you after we eat something.
Yep. Anybody's got any questions? We got a little bit of time.
Yes. In 2016, Congress passed a law requiring GMO labeling. And the rules for that are not out yet. And they're supposed to be out by July of 2018. So what you're asking is not yet known. The USDA has obviously done some preliminary work on this. We haven't seen any of it. So I can't answer your question because some of the things that will be voluntary, may not be under the new rule. So I'm not really sure how to answer your question. There's going to be labeling though. And will it prevent people from labeling things that are non-GMO? I don't know. But good question. I don't know how to answer your question, Janice. I would hope so. I'm wondering if you had any thoughts on that, or Janice is a better expert than I am.
You know, have you guys heard of Soylent? Anybody into really building muscle mass? Okay, I know this may not be the primary crowd, but you know, there are a lot of people that are actively doing fitness. My nephew is one of them. He's in the training to be a Marine, and a lot of them are using protein powders and protein shakes and things like that. Soylent is one of the few companies that's proudly GMO. So instead of doing voluntary non-GMO, how awesome would it be if we had more companies that explained why they were proud to have GMO products within their food? And so I think that's the kind of thing that could really shift the whole conversation about GMO labeling, for at least for me. I'm great with voluntary labeling. It's different to have the piece with the non-GMO butterfly. We had a long conversation about that this weekend. And part of that is that's a whole marketing thing that you're paying, and then that marketing money is used to frighten people about GMOs. So does that help on the question?
Yes, sir.
I'm curious, just following up on this GMO thing, with the fact that so few in the U.S. are concerned about it, it's expensive or Cadillac because there's more inside of it, and it's no longer a big issue. Is it possible that with GMOs, it could become like that in the U.S. based on the data that you're seeing and not that many people consume?
I hope so, and I think your example of the chestnut was a good one. In Florida, they have citrus greening, which is promising to wipe out the citrus industry, and they're working on a GMO orange tree that will fix that. When we use these new gene editing techniques like CRISPR to cure Alzheimer's, yeah, that, then people are going to start to see real value in GMOs and biotechnology. I mean, you have something to...
I refuse to give up the hope that people will see science as a good thing. I mean, I absolutely refuse it, right? And so I think like Oregon and Ag in the Classroom kind of programs and stuff. So now if you have schools that want to learn about GMOs, we'll send them some Roundup Ready soybean seed and some non-Roundup Ready soybean seed and let them look at it side by side. And there's a curriculum that helps them understand how much damage weeds do to yields and how you're losing your water. And why you actually need to control weeds. It's not just because, you know, we're vain and we want a clean field. I mean, that's part of it for some of us maybe, but in reality, there's a real loss when you have weeds go uncontrolled. So I think there's a huge reason to think that we're beginning to make inroads. I know it's tougher to see it here in Oregon, but even the other night, Carl would say he saw some of it, you know, where people were asking about the Ugandan banana. That's a really starchy product, that it's their primary food, like potatoes are known to be the primary food in Ireland, right? Or rice in Asia. It's a GMO banana that could actually help save the lives of people. We need to do a better job of knowing those stories and being able to tell those stories and tell those stories to people who can reach lots of folks. And I think movies like Food Evolution and a documentary called Science Moms are both really good starts. And if you haven't seen those, watch them because you'll get the stories and you'll be able to pass them on to other people.
Anything else? Yep.
The EU's given glyphosate 5 years in this thing. What's going to happen in 5 years and how much we can do with their decisions?
That's a good question. In California, they're going to list glyphosate on Prop 65, which is going to be problematic. The data is pretty is powerful in favor of Monsanto's position. But again, data doesn't necessarily rule in the EU, where instead of a risk-based system, they have a hazard-based system. And I won't get into the details, but I don't know what the EU is doing. They are not self-sufficient in food right now. And they're going the other way, and they want food produced somewhere else. They don't want to produce in the EU. It's a weird situation. I don't know how that's going to turn out, but right now I'd have to guess not very well. Anything else? Is it lunchtime?
I think it's close enough.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.